Welcome back to Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. I'm Jack Llewellyn. As always, thank you for joining me. Before we get into the topic of the day, I have two preliminary things I want to talk about. One is a follow-up on our discussion from last week about Abraham Osaguirre Cervantes, Don Rodo, the older brother of El Mencho. And if you'll remember, he had been arrested on April 21st and had been, he was in Jalisco. He was then transported to Mexico City, transferred to Antiplano Prison. And then we talked that there had been a hearing and he had been ordered released. But at the time of our recording last week, we didn't know exactly what had happened to him as far as his release. Well, we learned that this week, Mexico's security minister, Rosa Rodriguez, announced at kind of her normal or the president's regular press conference, she said that Judge Rogelio León had, quote, surprisingly, unquote, ordered the release of Osaguirre, arguing that there were no legal grounds to charge or to keep him in prison. She did say that the decree had been questioned by a Supreme Court justice. The justice had been asked to intervene, but elected not to overturn the judge's decision. There is little information about where Osaguirre is now after he was released from Antiplano Prison. One thing I want to say, and this may not be a completely popular position, clearly corruption is significant in Mexico. Corruption within the judicial system, the prosecutorial system, the criminal justice system is clear. Remember, though, in this particular case, there were numerous witnesses who came to testify for Osaguirre, right? Specifically with respect to the weapons charges against him. There was a 17-hour hearing during which time all reports indicate most of the evidence, most of the testimony, most of the witnesses were in favor of Osaguirre, very little from the prosecution. And after that 17-hour hearing was when the release order was issued. And then remember, there was this review by a justice from the Supreme Court. Is it possible that all of that evidence and stuff was a complete charade and there really was a payoff? Of course, given Mexico's system, it's possible. Is it also possible that the prosecution didn't do a very good job in presenting its case against Osaguirre, at least at this stage of the proceedings? And I submit that that's also possible. And of course, then there's the gray area in between. So my point only here is that it's very, very easy, very convenient to say everything is corruption. That's not always going to be the case. So just wanted to bring that out. I will let you know in the coming weeks if we learn more about Abraham's location. Something else I want to talk about before we get into the topic today is actually a personal favor slash recommendation, however you want to describe it. So my friend, Stephen Tubbs, who is an award-winning journalist, he was on ABC News. He's done a whole bunch of things. He was a longtime radio talk show host in the Denver area. He is currently the PIO for the DEA Rocky Mountain Division. He has put together a documentary on the fentanyl crisis, particularly within Colorado, but it has ramifications for areas far outside of Colorado. The trailer and all the pertinent information can be found at www.devastatedco.com. like Devastated Colorado, devastatedco.com. The film will be available for streaming after May 15th at the Mountain Time Media YouTube channel, Mountain Time Media on YouTube. There are several premieres in the Denver area, almost all of which I'm unable to make, unfortunately. Stefan does an amazing job. I promise if you have an interest in this topic at all, you'll be interested in his documentary. Again, that's www.devastatedco.com. Okay. Let's talk about the topic of the day. So as I've said several times on here, I scan social media a lot for topic ideas for the podcast, things for the newsletter, just to try to be informed. Sometimes I get good information. Sometimes I get bad information. Sometimes I get conflicting information. And I have a general curiosity and interest in how social media is being used. In that regard, I ran across an article this week that I thought was very interesting, detailing issues relating to cartels and their use of social media. So I thought we would talk about that today. And what we're going to do is we'll first talk about some of the thematic elements that come from the article that got me onto this topic. Then we're going to look at a couple of the specific operational methodologies that are used by cartels. We'll look at a bill pending in Congress with respect to that, and then we'll kind of conclude. So, cartels and social media. Most analysts say really developed in any significant way 2005 to 2006. Certainly there were things before that, but also go back and think, you know, that's 19 years ago. Social media was much different than it is today. In many ways, it was in its infancy. Note also that timing, 2005, 2006, also relates to the administration of President Felipe Calderon and to his anti-drug efforts. And you can kind of see how it all might have developed. Early on, you had kind of tech-savvy gangs, drug cartels that were weaponizing social media. And it was a practice that kind of advertised their exploits. Some called it cyber banging. What we know now is with the advent and the growth, the exponential growth of social media platforms, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, YouTube, Reddit, I can name, you know, you could think of many, many more. But these platforms have been used by cartels in kind of obvious ways and some more sophisticated ways. They enable gangs, drug cartels to taunt and threaten rivals. They sell drugs and contraband. They coordinate attacks. They lure victims. All of these things. The article I was looking at and referring to comes from the Global Network on Extremism and Technology, and it was written by a Dr. Robert Bunker, B-U-N-K-E-R. And I'm going to summarize some of it for you because I think it's very interesting. And I'm going to put these into narrative themes. The use of social media is founded on, or social media use by cartels, I should say, is founded on certain narrative themes that run through many of the social media uses, many of the social media posts. And I think they are very important to understand. So the first we want to talk about is the narco-cultura promotion. Dr. Bunker says, in part, that cartel culture is a ubiquitous and organic component of day-to-day life and found throughout all forms of the narco social media. It's, he says, similar to gang culture, but with a more developed and more economic resources available. So it feeds these notions and these archetypes of rural banditry, criminality, and even like even cult-like activities. He goes on to say that what's interesting, and I think we've seen this in a number of different situations, is these cartel influences, this narco culture, is also intertwined with regional traditions, Catholic practices, and what he calls a special relationship to the dead that is unique to Mexico. In this narco culture, he says concerns about acquiring materialistic things dominate, given the subsistence and lower social economic backgrounds of the majority of cartel members. And we've talked about that repeatedly, right? Recruitment focuses heavily on the idea that you're poor, you're always going to be poor, but your way out is by working with the cartels. You know, in essence, the narco culture, and this is a direct quote, I think this is important. The narco culture, quote, provides a means for the very poor in Mexican society to achieve great wealth and even fame if they have the cojones to do so. He goes on to say that different subcultural phases have existed. These include things like the Sinaloa Cowboys, the Crew Cut Zeta Commandos, Narco Polo Wear, and the Knights Templar, to name just a few. He also reiterates the notion of the unique narco perspectives on death, evidenced by, as an example, large monuments built in the Jardines del Humaya Cemetery outside of Culiacan. Another prominent theme in these narco culture, narco social media is the machismo, right? And obviously, I'm a gringo. We all know that. But I think it's fair to say that we all know that the machismo characteristic is not only stereotypical in Mexico or in much of Mexico, but it's stereotypical for a reason. It predominates in the culture in ways that may be unique to Mexico. So Dr. Butler says, or Dr. Bunker, excuse me, I apologize. He says, the cartel lifestyle is hyper-masculine and hyper-violent, both in its behaviors and its imagery. And he says, you know, kind of the Scarface, Tony Montana archetype is constantly evident. And kind of the flip side of machismo is that it promotes a skewed perspective on the role of women, both within cartels and society in general. The notion of economics also flows into this machismo theme in narco culture, narco social media, with the idea that life is cheap, right? And only the smartest, only the most brutal bosses and organization survive the narcotics trade. At the lower level, life is all about fast living, and it's centered around owning flashy cars, having expensive clothes and jewelry, alcohol, drugs, clubs, young women, all of these, again, stereotypical ideas of cartels and cartel members. And I'll tell you, you know, even in my limited experiences in Guadalajara, you can see evidence of that almost on a nightly basis without even looking hard. And I'm sure it's prominent in far more areas than that. The idea of this fast living, the machismo style, is more prominently displayed in social media on an individual level. So individual member postings, their social media pages, than it would be on kind of more cartel-oriented social media postings. Images of beautiful women predominate. And he goes on to say that in many places or many of the cartels, many organizations, even female guards and assassins must be good looking, as that is an essential component to the narco-fueled masculine fantasy. I kind of like that. The narco-fueled masculine fantasy. Another theme that's characteristic of social media use by cartels is the idea of trucks, weapons, and, you know, enforcers, sicarios. The idea is that in order to portray the power of their gang, their cartel, their organization, their group, these social media posts have videos, pictures of their combat forces to show the sophistication and the size and again, that machismo of the units, the cartels, and the individual members. Probably the most prominent in that is the elite CJNG units. And we'll see others. You'll see pictures of CDS and CDG, you know, all dressed up and ready to go in tactical gear and stuff. But CJNG has really taken it to a new art form. And they are prominently displayed. They're all over social media. And I think it's an evidence of CJNG's very strategic and organizational use of social media. Imagery of these CJNG units, according to Dr. Bunker, have repeatedly been posted with their members wearing better uniforms, tactical harnesses, and carrying more sophisticated and, importantly, matching weaponry, riding in more imposing vehicles, all to show the increasing power of the individual members and the cartel itself. Cartel and commander branding is also very important and a key theme in the use of social media. Typically, branding is reserved for leaders of cartels, special unit commanders, plaza bosses. Some of them get cordos written about them. Some are see their branding, you know, extending to images and videos. You'll see cartel logos, personal symbols, personal designations, accompanying ballads. You know, as a simple or a couple of simple examples, you know, the silhouette of El Chapo, easily recognizable, and is a logo that is used even today while he sits in Supermax just down the road from me. If we go to the Zetas, remember the idea that everybody was, you know, that they were the Zs. You had the, you know, the commanders with the Z. Well, that wasn't just a way to designate people. It also was really a logo. It was a brand. It was a branding of the cartel. And then it was a branding and a recognition of the leaders. You know, again, remember we had, you know, Z40, Miguel Angel Treviño, as just an example. They were readily identifiable. You knew immediately Z40, even if you didn't know the name, you knew it was a Zeta and you knew it was somebody important, right? And that recognition is valuable in online posting, online recruiting, online threats. Typically speaking, Sicarios don't become social media stars. But there was one people might remember. So this goes all the way back to like 2013 and the Knights Templar. And there was a Sicario by the name of Broly Banderas. And he wasn't necessarily a social media star, but he had a following because he had lots of photos that were posted online. He had good looks. He had charisma. And he took these selfies that were like bad boy, almost teen idol-like selfies. And he did become popular. But again, the idea is that typically the social media fame, if you will, or notoriety is reserved for leaders, commanders, or plaza leaders. One thing that we've seen a lot is a rise in the posting of interrogations and torture videos. Most of those are secular, but Dr. Bunker notes that some also have what he calls dark spirituality and magico-religious elements. But those are clear elements of the modus operandi for cartels. It allows them to terrorize opposing groups. It really is kind of a psychological operation, psyops warfare. A lot of these include brutally taped or videotaped brutal confessions. And they are posted on social media. They get wider dissemination. The impact is felt wider by more people. It intimidates more people. It promotes the cartel's willingness to do anything. And their simple power. Look what we can do to a Sicario or a leader of our cartel, or in the case of CJNG, look what we can do to those who betray us in particular. So these torture killings have increased in number over the years. They've increased in the barbarism, and there are numerous videos that you can find online that you really wouldn't want to watch. One of the things that cartels have done in the past that's very interesting, we've talked about it before, is the way they interact with local communities and provide kind of social benefits to the communities in which they associate. And we've seen, you know, around Christmas time, cartels providing gifts to local residents, local children. Many other examples. Social media heightens this. And Dr. Bunker calls it social banditry. So they'll try to cultivate goodwill and influence with their populace by responding to tragedies. So in November 2017, there was a large earthquake in Mexico. A number of cartels, especially in this particular case, CDG, provided post-earthquake aid and sought to capitalize on that by posting on Facebook and other places. In the mid-2020s, during the COVID crisis, numerous cartels, including CJNG and CDS, provided COVID aid, sometimes participated in quarantine enforcement, did other things around the COVID crisis and publicized it on their social media. One of the other things that we've seen a lot and definitely an increase in recent years and even months are far more videos and social media posts showing raw footage of violence between cartels and government forces, vigilantes, cartel versus cartel postings, gun battles. I swear you see them almost every day without hardly looking. Sometimes they're just raw footage. Sometimes they're more edited and they've got narco corridors or other music behind them. Obviously, in this day and age with cell phones and other cameras, it's so easy to do, but it's a very effective tool, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Drone imagery, especially over the U.S.-Mexico border, is far more prominent now, and it is used for propaganda purposes. Sorry. There are town defense forces, autodefensas, fighting the cartels that also will utilize drones to post overflight videos. They will embed reporters to talk about the situation, to discuss the dire circumstances that they're in. So these drones and social media isn't always pro-cartel. So those are kind of the narrative thoughts. What about operational efforts? Most of which we've talked about, but let's summarize them. One of the primary operational efforts is intimidation and extortion. And you can see that in a number of ways. Think about narco corridors and the responses of cartels to some of those postings. We can go all the way back kind of before social media, and there's the famous murder of Chelino Sanchez, a very prominent Mexican singer, Peso Plumo, was very publicly threatened for praising El Chapo in his songs, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of it. One that I'm thinking of where a singer was on stage, gets passed a note, and apparently the note was that he's going to be killed afterwards because he was singing in praise of El Chapo. There are examples of this that go to the social media world as well. You've got social media star Juan Luis Lagunas Rosales, who had apparently his big thing was he would post videos while he was going on drug-fueled and drunken binges. Many of his videos ended up saying bad things about El Mencho, and bad things happened to Juan Luis. There was also a TikToker by the name of Carla Pardini, who may have insulted the wrong people. She was also killed. There was a YouTuber and TikToker who designated herself as the Narco Queen, Sabrina Duran Montero. She was gunned down on the streets. There was a YouTuber in Texas who prominently bragged that he stole $50,000 from the cartel, and he was disappeared. There are many, many, many more examples. And there are other examples of how, from an operational perspective, cartels will use social media to intimidate rivals, to intimidate the public, to extort those not supporting their position, those who are in some way advocating for, providing praise for, or otherwise supporting those against the cartels. One of the biggest areas, though, for social media, again, is recruitment. And we talked about this above. Four people in Mexico, primarily poor men in Mexico, who see little economic change in their horizon. They're poor today. They're going to be poor tomorrow. They're going to be poor next year. Are ripe for recruitment. And they can be recruited directly. They can also be recruited indirectly through social media. And that recruitment can also be overt or subliminal. But you see people who once were in your economic position, who now are dressing well, who were clubbing with beautiful women, who have nice cars. The lure is there. The allure of a better life is there. And social media makes that so much easier. Kind of tied to all of this is the idea that social media is an amazing propaganda tool for the cartels. There was an article written in the New York Times. It's a couple of years old, but I liked their summary when talking about this use of social media, particularly focused on TikTok. But they conclude by saying, this is the world of cartel TikTok, a genre of videos depicting drug trafficking groups and their activities that is racking up hundreds of thousands of views on the popular social media platform. But behind the narco bling and dancing gang members lies an ominous reality. With Mexico once again set to shatter murder records this year, experts on organized crime say TikTok is just the latest propaganda campaign designed to mask the bloodbath and use the promise of infinite wealth to attract expendable young recruits. It's narco marketing, said Alejandra León Olvera, an anthropologist at Spain's University of Mercuria, who studies the presence of Mexican organized crime groups on social media. The cartels use these kinds of platforms for publicity, but of course, it's hedonistic publicity. One of the things that I think is interesting in the propaganda war is the idea that there are legitimate news sources that are assisting this propaganda in maybe unintentional ways and maybe ways that can't be avoided. And I'm going to refer to Borderland Beat here. And if you read the newsletter or if you followed me on these podcasts much, I refer to Borderland Beat a lot. They do a great job, got lots of good information, not contesting, you know, their value at all, not even criticizing them at all. But this last week, Borderline Beat had an article where, and videos and pictures, I think there were videos, I know there were pictures, discussing where CJN members had ambushed Mexican army personnel in the town of La Higuera. Higuerilla. Man, I'm trying, folks. I really am, I promise. But that's in the municipality of Santa Maria del Oro, which is located in southeast Jalisco. It was a shootout between CJN members and the Mexican army. No lives were lost. Some soldiers were injured. And the propaganda of the CJNG were so strong, we're so powerful, we're attacking elements of the Mexican army. We're so powerful in our region. You know, look at us. That gets repeated through sources like Borderland Beat, through legitimate or other legitimate news organizations, Milenio and others, not to mention, you know, the cartels itself using them on social media. And so this propaganda going out, this recruitment effort, this notion that the cartels have an avenue for you, if you're poor, if you're despondent in Mexico, come join us. That gets repeated almost on a daily basis, even if not by the cartels. What is the U.S. doing about this? Well, or trying to do about this? The short answer is not much. The longer answer is there may have been an effort. In the last session of Congress, Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema, the chair of the Senate Border Management Subcommittee, Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, who is the ranking member of the subcommittee, and Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, Republican Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee, introduced the Combating Cartels on Social Media Act of 2023. I'll note there had been the Combating Cartels on Social Media Act of 2022, but it was never passed, so it was re-entered as the Act of 2023. The idea behind this proposed act is to establish and implement a national strategy to combat illicit recruitment activity by transnational criminal organizations on social media and online platforms to fight back against cartels using online platforms to recruit for smuggling operations along the Southwest border. Man, that sounds something like something that was written by Congress, right? By enhancing cooperation between governmental agencies and private platforms, the bill says, the strategy will help law enforcement hold cartels accountable while also giving border communities in Arizona the tools they need to engage with and educate at-risk youth who are targeted by the cartels. The act also requires the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to analyze cartels' illicit usage of social media and establishes a portal for technology companies to report cartel recruitment efforts in the United States to DHS and state and local partners. The legislation was entered after a Senate Homeland Security Committee hearing. During that hearing, there was a commitment, and let's put commitment in air quotes, from four leading social media platforms to share cartel recruitment content with DHS, a task that would be made easier through the development of a dedicated information sharing portal that would be part of the act if it's passed. Now, obviously, I like this, you know, a commitment from four leading social media platforms to share cartel recruitment content. Isn't that one where the devil's in the details? How do you determine what's cartel recruitment content? How is it actually going to be administered? Yes, there's an information sharing portal, but I think how you define this, how you define recruitment, how you define cartels, could make the actual process far more difficult than you might think. Senator Sinema, in this hearing, questioned social media executives about how the algorithms used by their platforms can amplify and promote cartel-sponsored content, and specifically asked TikTok and Meta executives what their companies were doing to prevent cartels from using their platforms to recruit teenagers, etc. The bill is still in committee, and according to one of the tracking agencies, has a less than 50% chance of being passed. I reached out to Senator Sinema's office to try to get more information on that. I probably did so later in the week than I should have. And so I don't have any information. But in the event that I get information on this from the senator's office, I will pass that along. All right. Lastly, I want to talk about kind of current uses of social media. One of the things that is getting a lot of attention now is that cartels are increasingly using social media to recruit people in the U.S. to support their smuggling. And when I say smuggling, that also includes human smuggling efforts and operations along the southern border. The migrant surge has kind of fueled this increased use of social media for recruiting people on the U.S. side to help in that process. And then we talked about Borderland Beat, and I said I didn't want to pick on them, but we can spend just a couple minutes online looking at, again, what I'll call legitimate news sources or information sites that regularly publish information that feeds into, directly or indirectly, and you can argue on the degrees to which, but which fuels the propaganda efforts of many of the cartels. You can see that in postings from 60 Minutes, CBS Reports, Vice News, Al Jazeera, documentaries. YouTube has dozens, if not hundreds, of channels dedicated to cartels. Many of those are Spanish-speaking only. Many of them allege that they are run by, or that the people talking, presenting information on them are former cartel members or associates. I think most of you can think of a half a dozen examples of this. So what's the idea here? What's the final point? What's a conclusion? Well, what we know is that cartels have effectively leveraged their social media use for various purposes, promoting those themes that we talked about at the beginning. And those purposes go from recruitment to tracking to threatening to blackmail, intimidation, all of these things. More importantly, what we need to recognize is that this digital landscape has become an integral part of their operations. And it allows the cartels to expand and extend their influence beyond physical borders. As a result, when we're talking about how do you combat the cartels, how do you, in a euphemistic, a general you, how does the American government, how does the Mexican government combat cartels, address intercartel wars? We have to think of these cartels as sophisticated entities that use social media and other sources to promote themselves, to protect themselves, to insulate themselves in ways that go beyond simple weapons and fighting and the violence that they perpetuate. If solutions don't, or proposed solutions, I should say, don't incorporate these extra territorial ideas, I submit that they're doomed to fail, and we're going to continue to see this cycle of, as we, the words were used earlier, expendable Mexican young males being recruited by and then frankly chewed up and spit out by cartels and the cartel wars that are going on today. Okay. That, my friends, is Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena for this week. Again, want to take 1 second and remind you of the documentary, and I'm going to do this for the next couple of weeks, but I think it's worth doing. Give me 1 second here. Stephen Tubbs, www.devastatedco.com. Available for free streaming after May 15th, Mountain Time Media on YouTube. Mountain Time Media on YouTube, devastatedco.com. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. I know it's going to be a quality product. I'm traveling this week, and hopefully I've got some interesting information for you when I get back. We'll figure out what that is between now and then. And that is it for today. Thank you for joining me. Everyone, have a great week.